of an even bigger number than that, but there's a lot of hardware to study, and that's what we teach each other. There's a tremendous amount of brain power in the New York City, New York area, New York City, Long Island, and Connecticut area. We try to tap into that. When people hear a subject being discussed and we're making an error, as we sometimes do, and there's no guarantees, please chime in and tell us the benefit of your particular wisdom and your experience in that particular area. The menu as to how John and Dick run the TechNet is that we take check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment for the net. So they give us their call letters, their name, because I'm so darn forgetful, and then the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. We don't require a long list of people telling us that they're listening after 29 years. This is TechNet number 1,394. The TechNets began in September of 1982, 29 and a half years ago. So by now, John and I and Rich and others who run the Limark repeater sort of believe that there must be people listening. Otherwise, the TechNet wouldn't have lasted that long. That doesn't have to be proven to us. So it's really the people with a real question or a comment that we're looking for. So we take questions and comments in the beginning. We make a sincere effort, don't always succeed, that during the first hour, at least a preliminary answer will be given to a person's question. In theory, you don't have to wait longer than an hour. After that, John goes to his mailbag, which we call Mel's Corner, in honor of Mel, K-E-Y. Mel Schneider, who for at least 6 years was a great aide to the TechNet in that he was accepting the emails from... He was accepting the emails from amateurs who didn't yet have their license, therefore they didn't have a voice to get onto the TechNet directly. The TechNet is primarily a live, good, free, a give-and-take, live, on-the-air conversation. We don't, except for the new beginners, we don't promise a written consulting service. That's a little bit beyond the call of duty. After two or three of the mailbags, and John might be able to tell us tonight his email address, because he's got a beautiful picture of a piece of equipment that he restored. From time to time, we've discussed a grid dip meter, and Measurements Incorporated made the Cadillac of grid dip meters. John has a copy of one. He has restored it. So if you really want to see what a Cadillac grid dip meter is like, that's a machine that you hold near a tuned circuit, anywhere from, a fraction of a megacycle up to at least 150 megacycles. You hold this circuit near the thing that you want to test, and it'll find the resonant frequency or frequencies. It has no harmonic response. It'll find those frequencies for you. That's when you use it in the grid dip meter mode. And you can also use it in the diode detect mode, where if there's a signal present on a coil that's nearby, it'll pick it up when you tune to that frequency, and then display it on a connector out the back where you can connect your phones. Very handy instrument. Fairly simple, not very elaborate, probably invented way back in the 40s, but modern today because of what it can do. If John gives us the Mel's Corner mailbag, then the next thing we go to is Paul, WS2N, a space expert, and he tells us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing lately. And from time to time, they do some pretty exciting things. After that, we go to slightly deeper subjects. Now, quite possibly, you're going to be hearing disruptive signals. And John and I both have some opinions on that, when people from the Midwest say, gee, why don't you guys just send out a fox hunting team and stop the disruptive signals? In the Midwest, where you've got nice flat lands and friendly people, that's a relatively easy thing to do. In the marble canyons of New York City, that's a much more difficult problem. You will hear disruptive signals from time to time. And you've got three choices when you hear that. You can get angry, decide you're going to turn off the rig, tune to some other frequency, I'm not going to put up with that. That's choice number one. Choice number two, because John and I, and the help of others, by way of listening on the input, we eventually get the person's question, and we repeat the question and eventually give them an answer. So the disruptive signals give us a delay, but it doesn't stop the operation. And the third choice is that you can wait until everything has been recorded. There's a very enthusiastic guy named Mike Perry, KC2NJI, who has a website that you can go to for the last 6 years the TechNet has recorded in its entirety, which is www.amateur, www.amateurradio.com. amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. You go to that particular website, and you'll hear all the recordings for the last 6 years of the Technical Net, usually within a day or so of this particular TechNet, by Monday night or Tuesday night. Usually the TechNet is there, so that you can listen to what took place and fast forward through the sections that have the disruptive signals to it. So you got three choices. And there's good reason to believe that the person who is sufficiently disgruntled that he feels that he must be doing disruptive signaling. Let me drop. I am guessing it is a person who lives very near the repeater site, who has a lot of time on his hands. He hears people enjoying their ham radio, sometimes through the TechNet and other kinds, and he is not happy with his particular life, is my best guess, and he thinks if he makes other people unhappy that he will be happier. It's a sad situation. We should feel sorry for the person rather than getting angry at him. Unfortunately, he's talked a couple of his friends into joining him, so some of his mobile friends are being used by him when they're taking the high risk of going out on the road to do their disruptive signaling. And so they're the ones that are at a higher risk. He is a little bit more protected in his particular environment for the time being. Various changes will take place over the next few weeks, which will hopefully make improvements in this situation. But it's a very serious one, as you can tell. And it's not an easy one to solve. It's not going to go away overnight. Okay, now's the time for people to check in because they do have a question or comment. So please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes at this time. I'll give you a typical sign-in. If, for instance, Jesse was going to sign in, it would sound like W2, Echo, Echo, Oscar, Jesse, and yes. That's what a sign-in would sound like if Jesse was signing in. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
November 9th. Whiskey Alpha 2, Papa Juliet Foxtrot, Vito, yes.
KD2BHY, yes.
N2XGN, after the space report.
So far we've got Rich, Vito from Bayshore, and Jim from Port Washington. And that guy Rich, he's in Whitestone. Rich, your audio is quite low tonight. I thought I'd let you know about that. So then when you do come back, you might want to speak a little bit closer to the mic. Maybe you picked up the back of the mic or the wrong mic. All righty, we've got three so far. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW, we got you too, Wes. Give me your names and call letters right now.
S2N, Paul, with the space report to Nick.
KT2WGB, with a question of my own. After Paul. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, we've got Paul and John. And one last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters right now and name. We have more than enough. And Rich from Whitestone, give me a little more audio and go right ahead with your question. N2, Echo Oscar. K2, Real Indian Woman. Go ahead, Rich.
Good evening, Jake. First off, I've been doing some work here and stuff got moved around. Audio sound better now, Dick?
It sounds quite a bit better. Still a little bit low, believe it or not. But loud enough that you can't easily raise it. And you should wait for the beep. I didn't. You got it, Rich.
Oh, okay, Dick. I just brought it up a little bit more. I think it should be sufficient. Two things. I want to give you a report on a couple of things. First off, 6 meters was open tonight with F-skip, not E-skip, definitely F-skip. Because it was steady, it wasn't that up and down fading. Worked into Argentina, LU9 Alpha Echo Alpha, and LU8 YDX in Argentina. Got a 5.9 out of them with kilowatt on 6. They were coming in like 5.5, 5.4. So apparently the cycle is starting to improve to the point where 50 megahertz is opening, whatever he said. Okay, wanted to mention, I'm glad James is on frequency. I've got the radio here that I had given him, and I did some work on it. You know, I guess I feel bad because I wasn't feeling very well when he picked it up. Normally I wouldn't have let it go like that. I thought it was in good shape. I bought it on eBay. It was previously restored by its former owner. And James had some problems that he brought up on the TechNet. So just wanted to let you know, the hum and the hum was just delaminations in the transformer. That's nothing. That's kind of normal. That's what I heard. But what I did find, Dick, was the person who restored it never tightened everything up. The basic problem was the indexing on the band switch was off because the set screw was loose. I took care of that. I found a couple of bad tubes. An OB2 regulator tube was glowing orange. It should be a violet color. It's a 105-volt regulator. I changed it. The VFO, the band spread was all screwed up on it. The guy had modified the VFO to stability, but he screwed up the linearity. Let me reset. The VFO back to normal, and I can talk between my radio and it. You know, it's 5kc increments, which is not very good. The radio sold new in kit form in the 1960s, like $152, I think it was. So, you know, they had to make price points. They band switched the VFO rather than using heterodyne crystals for each band. So they saved money. That's why it's not as stable as it could be. But I did get it working. Had a little mishap here. I don't know what happened. I got it done. And then the receiver section died. It didn't totally die. It's just very insensitive, so I got to go back into it, see what happened there. I got James a 100kc crystal calibrator, which I'm going to outboard the thing and wire it into the back of the radio so he can check the 100kc point. And I'm going to tell him to check it on a regular basis, especially when he's near a band edge with 5kc markings. Putting out about 130 watts on 80 and 40, about a little low on 20, about 75 watts on 20. And that's what we got the report on. The guy who wired his microphone, I thought it might be the mic, but he did a good job. He did a good job wiring the mic, no problem there. So I just wanted to let you know, Dick, because I feel kind of bad. You know, you give somebody something, you want it to work right. I was not feeling well. I'm feeling a lot better. I wouldn't let it normally go without checking it. Back to you, the K2RIW, TechNet Limelock, and Tulio. Maybe you can comment on the 6-meter opening.
I sure can. And for 6 meters to get all the way down to South America, to Argentina, I think you said, which is, I think, the southern tip of South America. There's a lot of miles there. And that might be also trans-equatorial. It turns out that 6 meters is called the magic band because of all the 40 different kinds, I'm exaggerating a little bit, 40 different kinds of propagation, 6 meters has almost every one of them. A little bit of, I don't know if it's got very much delay or absorption, but sporadic E, F1, F2, trans-equatorial, field-aligned anomaly, meteor scatter, moon bounce, aurora, satellite. There's a zillion different kinds of ways of getting the signal from point A to point B, and 6 meters, when it opens up, and this is the time of the year when 6 meters usually really comes alive. When you see, I'm looking at the May issue 2012 of QST Magazine, when you get your May issue in the section in the World Above 50 Megacycles, which has a new section runner now, John Jones, N0JK now runs it, and there's a lot of information there about 6 meters, what happened in February. A station way down there out in the Pacific called New Caledonia, Foxtrot Kilo 8, Charlie Papa. He talked to a whole lot of people across the United States, reaching all the way into West Virginia, at least that far, if you know what I mean. So you'll see some very nice reports, World Above 50 Megs, the May issue of QST when it comes out. 6 meters is a fun band. Let me drop. In the old days, 6 meters was so close to channel 2. Channel 2 is 54 to 60 megacycles, and the 6-meter handband is on 50 megacycles, and the television receivers didn't have very much rejection of a strong nearby signal 4 megacycles away. So 6-meter guys used to bomb their neighbors on 6 meters if they didn't install high-pass filters on everybody in the neighborhood. Nowadays, with digital television, where 6 meters is essentially not being used. There's a slight catch to that. There is a local low-power channel 42. It calls itself 42, but it really is on the old frequency of channel 2, 54 to 60 megacycles, but so few people watch it that if you operate 6 meters today, I think you get very little local television interference. On top of that, 99% of the population nowadays is on cable or satellite. Me and John why can't I think of his name? K2KEY. We're the only guys that are using over-the-air television. Using over-the-air television. The rest of the world is using some other cable service. So that 6 meters, there's a lot of reasons why you're going to get a lot of pleasure out of it these days. One of the things that amazes me as you read these articles, let me drop, is that one of the guys was hearing Foxtrot Kilo 8 Charlie Papa coming through from New Caledonia, and his high-power kilowatt amplifier was on the bench being repaired. He only had 50 watts or 30 watts of output for his transmitter. He was afraid to go on the air for fear he wouldn't be heard. He doesn't realize that when 6 meters opens, there are times when a 1-watt transmitter will get you some ridiculous distance. And let me give you a couple of words as to why that takes place. When you and I go from 1 watt of output to 30 to a kilowatt of output, 1 watt is pretty far down into what we call QRP, low power operation. And then you add an afterburner and you go up to 1,000 watts of output. As big a difference that is, 1,000-to-1 ratio, that's only 30 decibels on the decibel scale, which is what, the 6S units, let's see, 5S units. 5/6 of, yeah, it's 5S units on a well-calibrated S meter. That's what the signal strength difference you can generate by going from about the lowest power you're likely to use on most of the VHF, HF frequencies, all the way up to the maximum amateur power you're allowed to run in the CW mode. In the sideband mode, you're allowed to run 1,500 watts, which is now, what, 31 or 32 dB of increase from the lowest to the possible highest. So that's what you can do by adjusting your power. What can Mother Nature do? When the 20-meter band is not there, and you just barely hear somebody who's running a kilowatt and a full-size beam, a six-element beam aimed down in his throat at you, down your throat, so to speak, and he's running 1,500 watts of peak envelope power, and you just barely hear him above the noise because the band is not open, and then Mother Nature creates a E-cloud, an F-cloud, a real ionospheric reflection. Let me drop. The real ionospheric reflection, at times, can be an increase in signal strength of at least 80 or 90 decibels, sometimes 100 decibels. Mother Nature can make that much difference. When the signal is just going right through the ionosphere, because the ionosphere is not active at that frequency because it doesn't have enough ionization today, or this particular hour of this day, for that particular angle and whatever. So the ionosphere is not there, and a little bit of extended ground wave gets through, and you have to fight the background noise of the universe and man-made noise and everything else. I mean, quite often, the local noise you'll hear on an HF frequency could be S5 on your S meter, just the background noise, and then your signal has to compete with that. So what I'm getting at is Mother Nature can make a signal that was below S1 go to 50 dB over S9. Mother Nature can do that, whereas you can only move 5 S units on a well-calibrated S meter. So therefore, when Mother Nature is making that signal come through, just because you're running free power and you think you're not going to make it, give it a try. If Mother Nature has really opened that band, then free power can do it. So that's some of the things that people have to go through the learning curve to find out about 6 meters. Now, one other thing I wanted to discuss with Rich, and that is the when you helped Jim with the transmitter that you're loaning him, that transmitter has a receiver now that you're repairing, but I was a little bit worried whether or not the manual, we all go through a learning curve when it comes to tuning. When it comes to tuning the final stage of a transmitter, we all go through a learning curve of properly adjusting the tuning and loading control. And as such, reading the manual on how to do that, actually doing it physically in front of somebody who is skilled at doing it and knows how to adjust the meters and what to look for, there's a slim chance that Jim has not yet learned that skill, and maybe that's one of the reasons where Jim has made a few attempts at transmitting on HF frequencies and wasn't getting an answer. The tune-up procedure could be a variable in that particular case, Rich. So when you get a chance, you might want to go through that procedure. And when Jim comes back to your house to pick up the rig after you fix the receiver, you might want to go through that tune-up procedure just to show him, if you haven't already done that, Rich. N2EO for any further comment, K2RIW in the TechNet. And even if there's noise there, I'll hear you on the input. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, very good. Well, one correction. I gave him the radio. I'm not lending it to him. It's a permanent thing. It is to keep. And I did show him quickly how to load it up. I'm going to go over it again with him, but I think he understands how to do it. But I'm going to double-check that just to make sure. But like I said, Dick, I think the real problem, the basic problem was that the indexing on the band switch was not right. In other words, where the shaft goes into the coupling and couples to the other half of the switch, the set screw was never tightened by its former owner. And basically part of that switch was on one band, another part was on another band. Not good.
Sounds like you're doing some pretty serious troubleshooting on that rig that you've given to Jim. Very good. And so there's a good learning curve there. One of the things that happens to a brand new amateur, half of them all go through this situation I'm about to describe. They get their license, or they're in the process of getting their license. They don't yet have a transmitter and a receiver. And they start looking at the advertisements, and there is a large number of brand names and model numbers to choose from. And of course, the first thing the person will say is, how in the world do I choose a 5-watt rig, a 150-watt rig, an 80 through 10 meter rig, a VHF rig, a UHF rig? How in the world do I choose the band, the brand name, the model number, and whatever? Because there's a darn many ways to choose from. And that's because the person thinks, as a brand new amateur, he'd like to own a brand new piece of equipment. The very first car you and I own, we would love it to be a brand new car with the money supplied by the parent, if you know what I mean. And quite often we all start off with some used jalopy, and we learn how to drive on that thing. Well, when it comes to ham radio, you can save a fortune. I mean, a real good high power, a high end rig these days with 100 memories and all kinds of digital signal processing and whatever, you can easily spend $1,000, $1,500, $2,000 and beyond dollars on a brand new rig. Whereas if you're willing to use something that's a couple of generations old, something that was built in 1980 or 1990. On used flea market, where you can buy it for $100 or $150, and don't even worry about the fact that the front panel is dented and it got dropped down a flight of stairs. As long as most of the equipment is there, a guy like Andy, WA2CDL, who runs our tune-up clinic, he can fix anything. So don't be, you got very little dollars being risked when you buy a used piece of equipment. The one thing where you want to check with your friends is to find recommended brand names. Like, for instance, when it comes to a 2-meter all-mode rig, one that has single sideband and FM capability, my favorite is a Kenwood 711A. That's what you're listening to. My favorite rig. It's got the world's best synthesizer. It's only got 30 memories. Doesn't have quite as many horns and whistles. It's got a built-in power supply. You can run it on 12 volts or 110. It is a desktop rig. You could use it as a mobile, but it's a little bit on the bulky side as a mobile. But it's got a lot of nice capability. To buy that exact capability today, you couldn't do it for less than $1,500, closer to $1,800, to buy something as good as that rig. It's got a very good synthesizer in it. It's got a bulletproof front end and whatever. And on the flea market, used, that rig quite often can be gotten for $400, $300, sometimes $200. A lot of equipment in there for the money. So don't be afraid of buying used equipment for the first few pieces. And as long as you buy one that has a known good track record, that Kenwood 711, almost nobody has a bad word to say about it, except its size. And part of that size is because it's got a built-in 110-volt power supply. You don't have to supply 12 volts to it. Or you could supply 12 volts if you want to. So, and after you buy that used rig and use it for a couple of years and you decide to trade up with something more modern that's got... You decide to trade up to something more modern, it's got a whole lot of horns and whistles, guarantee you can resell that rig for almost exactly the price you paid for it and maybe a profit. two or three years later. It's money in the bank, if you know what I mean. So I'm a big believer in used equipment. When John finally gets his chance to tell us about his measurements incorporated grid dip meter, if I know John, he probably bought that on the used equipment market and for some awful nice price, whereas brand new, that thing probably sold for $5,000 in its day in 1975. We'll find out more about that when we get to John to give him that piece of information. So, sounds like you're doing a good job, Rich. Keep up the good work, and sounds like you're making Jim more and more happy, and as long as he's willing to wait a little bit, he's eventually going to have an awful nice rig. The next person who signed in was Vito. I like to get his call letters, Whiskey Alpha 2 Pilot Jet Fighter, W2PJF. Good old Vito from Bayshore. What would you like to talk about tonight, Vito? W2PJF, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, are you copying me firstly?
Loud and clear. You couldn't be any better. Keep doing it. You got it, Vito.
Okay, I switched over to a little more powerful transmitter than the other one I was using. Okay, my question tonight is, I've always been fascinated by the vintage flat-top antennas that you see in these 1920, 30 amateur radio books. The ARRL had one on its building at one time, I believe. Anyway, it was found on a Titanic. It had a 600-foot one. My question is, what is the principle of operation on an antenna of that nature? They usually have four or five wires, which I'm referred to as, I believe they're referred to as elements. The Titanic's massive one had four leading wires as well as four elements, and it had a secondary antenna as well. And one thing, how they work, they operate down at 400 meters, I think it was, 500 meters, something like that. Is there a driven element, a director or reflector like a beam? I'm not sure. I need information. I'm curious about what's the principal theory of operation of such an antenna in its day. Back to you, Dick.
If I took you literally, and I think you're probably right, when you said it was a 40-meter antenna, correction, 400 meters, 400 meters would be around 0.7 megacycles, pretty much the center or the low end of what we now call the broadcast band. That's where the antenna was approximately resonated, where the majority of the energy of that spark gap transmitter that was on the Titanic. And I think the Titanic was probably something like a 5,000-watt spark gap transmitter. It required a good-sized generator down in the boiler room to generate that power and the high enough voltage to create the arc that gave you the spark, that gave you the signal going to that antenna. In my opinion, Vito, that absolutely is not a beam. When you study beam-like antennas, you'll discover that you've got something called a driven element, which often looks like a dipole, but it could also be a cubical quad, but it's a dipole-like structure for the driven element. A Yagi, or a beam as we call it, also has a director out in front, which is something in the vicinity of a quarter or a half wavelength away, and that director is a little bit shorter than a half-wave resonant frequency. And if you've got a reflector, the reflector is something like a quarter wavelength behind the driven element. At a quarter wavelength, that driven element of the reflector is a little bit longer than the resonant frequency. Once you do that assembly of three elements in the Yagi-like structure I just described, what happens is that the signal is radiated by the driven element. The director out in front picks up that signal, but because it's tuned high in frequency, it starts re-emitting. The director re-emits a signal that's a little bit advanced in phase. The reflector picks up a signal behind the driven element because it's longer than the resonant frequency. It starts emitting a signal that is delayed in phase. Because you've got these three elements, one of them really driven, the other two are parasitic, but they're spaced a good fraction of a wavelength away, and they're slightly shifted in phase, that when you study what happens with that, it tends to give you a flashlight beam-like signal. I'm exaggerating a little bit. If your eye could see that in three-dimensional space, the actual pattern of that antenna would look like a watermelon or a cucumber. It's a pretty fat thing, but it's got a favored direction. But it takes wavelengths to do that. Now, when you were operating at a frequency of 400 meters, a quarter of a wavelength would be 100 meters, 300 feet away. To be a real director, there'd have to be 300 feet of spacing between one wire and another. Very unlikely. So it was not a beam. If you and I wanted to make a pure vertically polarized ground plane antenna, we'd start off with a nice flat conducting sheet of metal. We'd put up a vertical object. We'd make that vertical object a quarter wavelength long or longer, usually, and a quarter wavelength at 400 meters would be 100 meters high, 300 feet. You'd have to put up a mast 300 feet, and to go under the bridges of New York City with a mast like that on a Titanic, out of the question. They know that they needed a shorter antenna. You and I can make that vertical antenna shorter and shorter by giving it a top hat capacitor. The top hat capacitor consists of some wires or a structure that is parallel to the earth at right angles to your vertical radiator at the upper tip. So those four wires, in my opinion, that T-type shaped antenna really was a top hat capacitor, making that vertically polarized antenna resonant with a much shorter physical length, because I'm guessing the whole antenna was, you know, more like 150 feet high, 100 feet high off the deck, and those four wires going toward the bow of the ship and going toward the stern of the ship and being fed in the center with four wires, that was a vertically polarized, top hat loaded capacitor antenna. They got various other names for it, but that's what I think it was. They used the four wires in the vertical just to make sure there wasn't very much loss in the high current area. So that thing operated between the ground plane, which was the ship, and the top hat capacitor, which is the four wires that went from stem to stern. That's what I think it was. And by the way, there's no magic about feeding that kind of an antenna in the exact center. In theory, you could feed it closer to one end or the other. There's various ways you can resonate it. But it was, in my opinion, a resonant antenna, primarily vertically polarized, and those wires, as you add more wires, you add more capacitance to the top hat capacitor, therefore you're able to make the vertical portion a little bit shorter. Those are my guesses as to what it was. And so other people who are more familiar with a T-type, T-top antenna, which is what I'm calling it, I'm not quite sure what they call it, drag your feet a little bit, Vito, when I turn it back to you, in case anyone else has more smarts on that antenna and can tell us how the Titanic really worked. W2PNJ with a little bit of delay. K2LIW in the TechNet. You'll have no trouble getting over him, Vito, so go right ahead there, Vito. And by the way, you are giving me full-scale signal on my input, so I can hear you loud and clear, and even if your words don't come through, I will repeat them. You got it, Vito.
Okay, I hope you're copying me now. Okay, very well. Firstly, the power of the transmitter was 5kW, you're correct. And according to what I was reading, only around 500 watts was reaching the antenna. The antennas were horizontal between two masts, about 600 feet apart. And it was called a twin T, and the two wires were used for transmission and two were used for receiving, with four leading wires. And then, from what I was reading, that the leading wires themselves were also acting as radiators. It was about 190 to 200 feet above the deck, this antenna. It's like it looked like an old hammock. So I think we're both on the same wavelength as far as understanding what this antenna looked like. Am I correct, Dick? Go ahead.
Absolutely.
On the HT, you copy?
Yeah, we're hearing you on the HT, Rich. You want to give us a couple of words, Rich, before I address what Vito just said? You got it, Rich?
Little bit about those antennas, Dick. Dick, they didn't know about resonance in those days, or they barely knew. Those spark transmitters were very wide, and they used the antenna actually as the tuned circuit to get the frequency in large part. I think that was more or less a random wire. They had four wires. They coupled it with open. They fed it with open wire line, and the antenna actually the length of the antenna set the wavelength.
Yeah, I think you're right there, Rich. It turns out that now that I think about it, if he was down at what he believed to be 400 meters for his major frequency of operation, and just like Rich was saying, that the major tuning element of a spark gap transmitter in those days was the antenna itself. In other words, the spark gap is really making all the frequencies in the world. And so what frequencies get favored is where the resonance takes place. Very similar to when you're pushing a child on a swing. The weight of the child and the length of the pendulum, the length of the actual swing, determines the major frequency that the swing, that the child will swing back and forth. And so you tend to push at that frequency to build up a large oscillation. The child is moving at the resonant frequency of the swing, and if you wanted the child to move twice as fast or twice as slow, you'd be amazed how difficult that would be without making a large physical change to that swinging child on that swing. Same thing happens with the antenna. Now, because the ship was something like 800 feet stem to stern, and at least 600 feet of that or so was the antenna, he does have the ability to make the antenna horizontally resonant as well as maybe vertically resonant. So was it a horizontally polarized antenna or a vertically polarized antenna, and where the lead-ins were doing the radiating as well as the T-top, the twin T? There's various ways that antenna could be excited, and as long as it radiates that signal somewhere in the space and the ionosphere takes over, you can then talk to other ships and talk from ship to shore. So right now I'm not absolutely sure what the resonant looked like. I mean, did that antenna have horizontal polarization or vertical polarization? I know it had a combination, Vito. The only thing left for you and I to discuss is, was the horizontal portion of the signal coming off that antenna, was that 80% of the power and 20% was vertical, or vice versa? There's various ways they could tune it to make it happen. But that was a popular antenna in those days. There are other ways they could have built even higher performance antennas, but they hadn't yet learned about them. And so are you thinking of possibly building one of those for your backyard, Vito? Would that be a fun transmitter in Bay Shore? And by the way, the last time I visited ARRL headquarters, a whole lot of years ago, they did have a demonstration spark gap transmitter, as does my friend who lives in Smithtown, George Flanagan, W2KRM. Quite often he goes around giving demonstrations of real operating spark gap transmitters. Very noisy, by the way. When you're nearby the thing, a 5 kilowatt, by the way, spark gap. Quite often the actual sparking was done in another room. They called it the quiet room. In other words, they would put the sparking mechanism in a soundproof room so that the radio operator at his operating station wouldn't be hearing his loud signals and having his hearing deafening, to, if you know what I mean, desensitized, so to speak, so that when he goes back to the receive mode, he'd be able to hear what's going on. So noisy transmitters, but they put out a whole lot of frequencies, and ARRL has an operating spark gap transmitter, and I went to my demonstration quite a few years ago. They demonstrated how it worked, and they sent my call letters out into the air with the spark gap transmitter very briefly, because they knew darn well it was creating local television interference and cable television way back in those days when I first visited them. When I wrote my first article and then visited them, cable television hadn't yet become popular. But spark gap transmitters have a very interesting history. The very first truly microwave, millimeter wave transmission was done by Subramaniam Bose in 1890, and he was doing it at 60 gigahertz, and that was a spark gap transmitter. Back to you, Zito, and thank you for bringing this interesting story. And today is the day, 100 years ago, that the Titanic went down. About, I think it went down like 2 in the morning, and this is now, 8:30 at night, so something like, let me think, 18 or so hours ago is when the Titanic went down, 100 years ago. W82PNJ, the real radio voice of Bay Shore, K2RIW, you got it, Vito.
Dick Antuio, you know, real quick, in those days they thought the more wire the better. I believe those wires, those four wires in that hammock-like structure were paralleled.
They sure were, and you can see that in the pictures there, Rich. Wait for all four beeps when we hand it back to you, Vito, and then you got it, Vito.
Okay, very good. Yes, the more wires, the better. I did read that. There was much literature to be found, there is much literature to be found on the computer about the complete installation of the antenna system, the radio station, and so forth aboard that ship. Yesterday is the day of the Titanic sinking, leaving the surface around 2:10 in the morning. I'm correct in saying so. There were two separate rooms. There was the quiet room, as you mentioned. There was a receiver room and a transmitter room. And you couldn't stay in the transmitter room because you couldn't hear. So I was reading about that as well. The average range of that transmitter, 5 kW at only 500 watts, on the average reaching the antenna was about 250 miles. But they had conditions when it would go up to 1,000 miles. Again, I'm guessing, as you had said, Mother Nature did step in on the situations of that nature. About 6 or 8 months ago, let me drop. I'm almost finished with this. About 6 or 8 months ago, there was some recognition for spark gap or vintage transmitters. A gentleman had one operating on 20 meters, and the signal was very broad, and it was very raspy sounding, no tone whatsoever. It was annoying, but I'm surprised he had gotten permission to operate this transmitter. It was on for several hours, so it took out a good segment of the band. But it was very fascinating listening to him. He made many contacts. I was listening to all this going on for a while. Okay, and the final thing is to build such an antenna would be such a conversation piece. I have 200 feet of property, plenty of depth, but not as much as the Titanic, but I can build something out there. But I often thought about that antenna. It's so gigantic in its day, and I guess very inefficient, as you had mentioned, versus what we have today. Okay, I'm through. I'm tying things up too much. God bless. Thank you so much. Back to you, Dick. And my call is Whiskey Alpha 2, Papa Juliet Foxtrot, Vito from Bayshore. Back to you, Dick.
Yes, we are two pilot jet fighters, W-2 Papa Juliet Foxtrot. Very fine, Vito. Be careful with the word inefficient. You may be able to say that there are HF antennas today that have more gain and more directivity. They can aim the signal a little bit more like a flashlight. But of all the watts that finally left the transmitter and really got to that antenna, it is my guess, Vito, that 95% of those watts got radiated into space. The only way that an antenna can really be inefficient, and if you're now using the word efficiency from the point of view of conservation of energy, in other words, if I put 500 watts of power into the antenna and 480 watts get radiated into space and another 20 watts gets turned into heat, that's very little inefficiency. That's a very high efficiency antenna. The only way an antenna can truly be inefficient is to turn some of your valuable RF energy into heat. And I guarantee those wires ran ice cold. The only way that antenna could be inefficient is that, yes, if you operated it above very low conductivity soil so that the local dirt on the ground underneath the antenna became a dummy load resistor and took some of the locally radiated signal and turned it into heat and heated up the worms in the wintertime. That's one way that an antenna can be inefficient as a system, but the antenna itself, in this particular case, above a steel ship, above a highly conductive saltwater ocean, I'll bet you of the 500 watts or so that maybe got to that antenna, I'll bet you the majority of those watts got radiated. Now, another way of talking about efficiency, really people are talking about gain, pattern. And the biggest inefficiency from my point of view in those days was the receiver. You didn't really have tube amplifiers for the transmitter and tube amplifiers for the receiver. Lee DeForest hadn't done his thing yet. They hadn't become popular. So you really had nothing but a crystal diode front end. And that crystal diode, by modern-day standards, was a cat's whisker on a piece of galena. That's what I think it was. A sort of a very sloppy crystal diode. Very inefficient. I'll bet you the receiver had, I'll pick a number, a 40 decibel noise figure. Whereas a well-made receiver these days can have a 1 decibel noise figure. The lower the number, the better, the higher the sensitivity. So the receivers were not very sensitive. Therefore, the transmitters had to run real high power. And as long as the ionosphere, the good news about the ionosphere at nighttime is that those signals will go pretty far at numbers like 400 meters. I believe the D layer at high noon, at some in the daytime, gives you a lot of absorption, and that makes the range a hell of a lot smaller. What's really sad is that the Carpathia, thank goodness, had a radio operator that during his off hours went back to the radio room, did a little more listening, and heard that the CQ distress and SOS being sent by the Titanic in a real panicky mode, and he realized what it was and woke up the captain on the Carpathia and talked him into turning around and going back and picking up those survivors. The California was a lot closer, saw the rockets being issued by the Titanic, thought it was just a celebration and ignored it, and they could have rescued a hell of a lot more people, is one possible conclusion. So in the investigation that took place after the Titanic disaster, they soon realized that you really need a radio operator on duty 24 hours a day, because even a so-called unsinkable ship can run into an iceberg and be sunk. I think I've heard one report that because the lookout on the Titanic gave the warning about the iceberg dead ahead, the captain ordered full reverse and hard left rudder, and he ended up sliding alongside of that iceberg and ripping off the side of the ship, a great big gash that opened up four or five of the sealed compartments, which was beyond the number that the ship could survive, and therefore it sank. I think it's possible that had he done nothing except put on full reverse power and hit the iceberg head on, he would have crushed the bow of the Titanic, and it would have been an ugly looking mess, but the ship would have kept on floating. It would have survived. With hindsight, what he did, he tried corrective actions, and it was the wrong thing to do, we now know. That's one possible analysis. Anyone else who has more knowledge about the Titanic, give us your call letters right now. It's a fun subject on the 100th anniversary, which is today. Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2GJE, comment on Spock. Over.
K2GJE. And you've signed in lots of times, and I'm staunch forgetful. Start up with your name, sir, and tell us your knowledge of Spock. You got it, sir.
It's Ed. Spock, when it was sent, was not raspy. They used a rotary gap, which actually modulated it, and it sounds very good. I think it's W2KRM has some rotary Spock sets that he uses for demonstration. Back to Dick, over.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Ed, from Bohemia. Yes, the rotary Spock gap that they would use, if you rotated the individual conductors on something that looked like a fast record player, if you know what I mean, and if you had the 12 conductors around the perimeter and the sparking was taking place around those edges, you could easily make a 600 hertz note out of that. It was a slightly raspy sounding note, but it would be a 600 hertz note that's being transmitted every time the guy presses down the key. A lot more pleasant to listen to, probably a lot weaker signal could be interpreted because of the way it was being modulated. And some of the skilled operators at the end of transmission would turn off the motor to the rotary spark gap mechanism at the same time they were signing off, sending their SK, end of transmission, da-da-da-da-da-da. But instead of it being a tone that's continuous, you would hear da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, it'd be a descending tone as the rotary spark gap was slowing down as the guy was signing off. It gave it a little bit of personality. And so and George will also differentiate the various kinds of transmitter that were in operation those days. He differentiates arc from spark. In one case, there is a high voltage DC and a kind of an inductor that creates a raspy tone of some kind, and the other one is the rotary spark gap machine. So there is a difference between arc and spark, but in either case, the high voltage jumping across those terminals, in some cases the jumping was done in air, in some cases it was done in an inert gas, sometimes in a small chamber with a very strong local magnetic field. There are various ways of putting more power into the arc, making the arc more dependable, more characteristic in its frequency and its amplitude and its impedance, so the impedance match to the antenna, and various ways of with the large local magnetic field, the arc would actually move around a circle inside of the arcing chamber. Therefore, it wouldn't burn a hot spot on the electrode, and so your electrodes would last a much longer period of time. It didn't require as much service. I'm amazed how little we hear about the so-called coherer, which really is a kind of a crystal diode detector. In some cases, I think that the actual detection was taking place with a whole bunch of iron filings inside of a glass tube that when the RF energy hit it, it did get rectified. It gave you a sound into your earphones, and at the end of that transmission, a small hammer had to go and hit the iron filings to break them apart again to get ready for the next character that was being transmitted. I wonder if you have some more information about that one, Ed. K2GJE, if you do. K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, the coherer caused the iron, the signal coming down the antenna caused the iron filings to cohere, which made a separate circuit, and then there was some kind of device that banged against the tube and caused the iron filings to separate. I imagine receiving must have been very slow. Over.
I'm with you, Ed. It not only was very slow, and I guarantee it was very insensitive by modern standards. To make sure you have enough signal coming down the antenna that it would move those iron filings in a glass tube with contacts on the two ends and make them stick together by electrostatic attraction, we're talking about a significant number of volts. Whereas a good modern-day receiver will operate very nicely on a fraction of one microvolt. So modern-day crystal diodes with amplification, our receivers today have a tremendous increase in sensitivity to what they were working with in those days. But that was a developing art. These were the very early days of radio. And they had a long way to go to get where we are today. A modern-day radio, you study how much signal is really coming down the antenna, how much is really getting into the front end of the radio, and you calculate how far the electrons on average have to move in the antenna to do that transmitting or receiving. And you come up with amazingly small numbers where the electrons on average are moving a very small fraction of the diameter of an atom during the transmission. I mean, you'd be amazed how much tremendous amount of electrical charge there is in those zillions of copper molecules you've got in a piece of wire. If Mother Nature would let you do it, you could drain tremendous amounts of current out of that wire for a long period of time, just draining out the free electrons, the ones that are free to move. So it's opposite of common sense. What happens at the molecular level is really out of sight, if you know what I mean. Thank you for the information, Ed. We're now going to go on to Jim, and he's trying to get real familiar with four different kinds of ham radio simultaneously. Hey, Jim, you need a hobby. I'm kidding you, Jim. KD2, Baker November Yankee in Port Washington, K2RIW. You got it, Jim.
Hey, thanks, Dick. Yeah, I have two questions tonight. First of all, for giving me that radio and fixing it up for me. I mean, it's so generous and nice. Second of all, for the key you gave me. From when I received it, I was at 5 words per minute, and now I'm at 7.5. So that really helped, Rick, and hopefully when we get that transceiver fixed, I'll be able to make some CW contacts. So thank you so much for that. My first question is... Radio Shack, and I got, and I bought a kit, a soldering kit with it, and I soldered it up, and you know, it's a metal detector. It doesn't work, but it sure was a lot of fun making it, so it doesn't matter. And I was wondering, are there any good beginner ham radio homebrew projects that I could do.
First of all, Jim, I think the kit that you got from Radio Shack allowed you to do soldering, and I think that was part of the process by which, with a few people giving you some hints, you were able to modify the wiring of your microphone to make it appropriate for your particular transmitter. And according to Rich, when he inspected that microphone, it was wired correctly, and you made it work. I also bought a metal detector from Radio Shack that was being sold on sale a few years ago, and mine required a couple of 9-volt batteries, as I remember, and it did a moderate good job of doing metal detecting. When you do enough searching on the internet for metal detectors, and there are some very elaborate ones, by elaborate I mean slightly larger coils, slightly different mode of operation, so that people who like to really do beachcombing with a good metal detector can walk up and down the beaches and find bottle caps, coins, rings, all kinds of things. And it's a real kind of an adventure. When it comes to kits, ham radio kits or projects, I don't know if they still exist, but at one time, Radio Shack had a whole series of books that you could buy for a dollar or two a piece, pamphlet-like things, 101 projects that you can do with integrated circuits on vector board and things like this. In other words, you could make a code practice oscillator, an audio oscillator, a blinking light circuit, a square wave or triangle wave generator that'll make fancy-looking waveforms on your oscilloscope, if you had an oscilloscope. There used to be some nice sets of books that Radio Shack used to sell. Don't know if the store is going to have them, but if you go to the Radio Shack website, and if those books still exist, one of those books, for instance, was done by my good buddy WA5VJB, Kent Britton in Dallas, Texas. He had a series of books on how antennas work and how to make them work better and how to build homebrew antennas. One of the things you would like to do, your signal right now tonight, for instance, is a little bit weak on 2 meters, and if you followed the website of Whiskey Alpha 5 Victor Juliet Bravo.com, WA5 Victor Juliet Bravo.com, and you go to the second page of his website, you'll find a beautiful set of coat hanger antennas, or what I call them. Very simple, inexpensive antennas that you could build for 2 meters. You could build a 2, 3, or 4 element beam antenna, and if you mounted that beam antenna in the highest room of your particular house and ran a transmission line directly to your handy talkie or down the stairs to where the handy talkie is being used in the living room, if that's where you want to do it, by way of that high gain antenna where you could squirt the signal like a flashlight, so to speak, at this particular repeater, you'd be able to run your handy talkie at lower power, drain the battery more slowly, put in a stronger signal. So a homebrew antenna is one interesting project that I know you would get some pleasure out of, and there's a whole lot of others. Drag your feet a little bit in case there are other people who know about these Radio Shack project, ham radio project books or electronic enthusiast books that can tell us about. If there's anyone else that can give us some hints on that for Jim, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2QIQ.
Len recognized. Anyone else? Okay, hear it, Glenn, and tell us where your favorite books are available and how expensive. You got it, Glenn.
Well, this wasn't to mention books, Dick. It was really just to mention that there's a company called Ramsey Electronics, and they offer some really good kits, and you might just be interested in them. Look them up on their website, on the Internet, and just type in Ramsey Electronics, and there's some very good kits for the beginner. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
So I think you're saying that once you've got Google brought up, you just type in the word Ramsey, R-A-M-S-E-Y, Electronics, or could he do it directly by www.ramseyelectronics.com? Would either one of those work over to you, Glenn?
Yeah, I'm just looking at the, ramseyelectronics.com, all is one word, www, should bring it up as well.
And give us a quick hint. Name one or two or three of those kits. Name what it is and roughly how many dollars. Over to you, Glenn.
They make a code practice oscillator for like $15, a CW Keyer kit for about $35. They make a VHF mini receiver for like $50, some QRP receivers for like around